You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 6th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Attorney Scott Horton on the Department of Justice white paper memo describing what it considers to be the executive's authority to assassinate American citizens. Also on the program today, two members of the St. Louis Fed, or at least economists with them, say scrap patents altogether. Not necessarily directly related to the threat hanging over podcasters such as myself for infringing upon the patented idea of podcasting. Also, the post office announces plans to stop Saturday delivery as a means of getting Congress to do something. Pennsylvania, no Medicaid expansion. The budget deficit, including the sequester, or I guess contemplating the sequester, shrinks to well below $1 trillion. We'll get to that story about Karl Rove finding the latest way to make money. Nurses come out against Keystone XL. And today, a court will hear oral arguments. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit will hear oral arguments regarding the permanent block placed on the indefinite detention clause of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. But first up, a perhaps even more earth-shattering story. It seems WorldNet Daily has an exclusive, ladies and gentlemen, an exclusive that I'm reporting to you now. Rick Santorum urges board not to cave to the intolerant liberal mind in regarding the Boy Scouts allowing chapters to make it their own determination as to whether or not they're going to discriminate against homosexuals. Yes, Rick Santorum has written a piece in WorldNet Daily, an exclusive piece, saying that among the long list of liberal victories is the growth of the welfare state, sexual liberation, removing God from the public square, abortion, affirmative action, redistribution of wealth, more government control of businesses, radical environmentalism, and the transformation of the family. Actually, there's not a lot there that I don't feel quite proud of, but be that as it may, in a relatively short time has had consequences, these victories, he writes. One that has received relatively little attention is what Christina Hoff Summers called the war on boys. She describes how public schools have made little boys try to compete in a system designed for little girls and how they're failing. And of course, this raises the specter of the Boy Scouts not being the Boy Scouts. I believe what makes the Boy Scouts so successful, therefore, is loyalty to its first principles, its history, its understanding of what it means to live in duty to God. Wednesday's vote, speaking of last week's vote, is a challenge to the Scouts' very nature and is another example of the left attempting to remove God from all areas of public life. This change will allow local troops to decide for themselves. And those local troops that stick with the traditional core principles could continue without fear. But that won't happen because of lawsuits, he says. He urges the members of the board to read Boy Scout law. It's filled with words that have long left the popular lexicon when applied to young men. But I suspect traits you would value in your employees: trustworthy, loyal, courteous, thrifty, obedient, clean, and reverent. Yes, the Boy Scouts are not of the popular culture. They haven't transformed themselves to keep up with what is cool or trending. So in the mind of the intolerant liberal mind, wow. Apparently they don't have editors at WorldNet Daily. They must be forced to conform. Scouting may not survive this transformation of American society, but for the sake of the average boy in America, I hope the Board of Scouts doesn't have its fingerprints on the murder weapon. So they got this exclusive at WorldNet Daily, which, of course, when I first saw this, I thought the exclusive was that Rick Santorum still is alive. But apparently an exclusive at WorldNet Daily means that someone at WorldNet Daily answered the phone. And then, of course, this brilliant piece of prose ends with, read Rick Santorum's inspiring and patriotic book, American Patriots, Answering the Call to Freedom, now at WorldNet Daily Superstore. Exclusive! And that was the Majority Report exclusive reporting on what Rick Santorum said in WorldNet Daily. Apparently no one else cares. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Scott Horton about this Justice Department legal, or I should say memo, and perhaps its implications for the hearings of John Brennan tomorrow to be the CIA chief. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the contributing editor at Harper's, or a contributing editor at Harper's, I should say, Scott Horton. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you, Sam.
So, Scott, it was reported yesterday NBC got a hold of a Department of Justice white paper, which purports to outline the legal reasoning behind the administration's belief that the executive has the ability to order the killing — they wouldn't refer to it as an assassination — of American citizens abroad. And maybe that's even maybe I'm misconstruing even the notion of abroad, because it seems to me that the implications of this may be larger than what it states. But let's just start with your initial reactions as to who do you think made this available to NBC and why?
Well, this white paper was prepared for Congress and was disseminated on Capitol Hill to the Intelligence Committees and to several others. And I think it's pretty clear that we've got the John Brennan confirmation hearings coming up tomorrow, and that this was leaked by people on the Hill to provide some grist for those hearings. And I've got to say, I'm thankful to them for doing that, because my first reaction when I read this was one of outrage that a document like this was being treated as confidential and withheld. There's no reason why the public shouldn't know all this.
And in fact, I mean, this isn't even the initial document, right? This is a derivative of what we imagine should and probably does exist, that being an Office of Legal Counsel specific legal memo. Is that right?
Yeah, no conjecture about it. There's a 50-plus page memo that was done by Marty Lederman and David Barron, and this purports to be a summary of it. I don't think it's a very good summary, because I know Marty and David, and they're a lot smarter than this white paper is. It makes some real mistakes. So I'd say it's sort of a dumbed-down summary that probably misses a good part of the original analysis.
Well, so what do you perceive? Let's start with, let's talk about what is in this white paper, and then we'll get to one of the mistakes. But basically, give us an outline of what legal authority this white paper, I guess, reflects has been found in this OLC memo that the president has.
Well, I'd say generally there are two different ways to go about justifying the president's authority to use lethal force in an extrajudicial sense against an American citizen. So one is self-defense in the situation of urgency. I mean, just think about the situation down in Alabama at the beginning of this week where a school bus driver was shot and this guy grabbed a kid and was holding him hostage. So everybody would accept in a situation like this, the FBI can be authorized to use lethal force to save the life of that kid and potentially other people. So that's sort of self-defense scenario is one. And the other is laws of war or international humanitarian law. You're out on the battlefield. People are coming at you. You can shoot at them if they're wearing an enemy uniform, and it doesn't matter that they're a U.S. citizen. So those are the two prongs that exist. And the memo actually spins off of each of those prongs. And it comes to focus on a question of imminence. That is, you know, when is the threat to U.S. persons or property, when is that so imminent that a strike of this sort can be justified? And I think everybody agrees there has to be this element of imminence. And the really shocking thing about this memo is that you discover that imminent doesn't mean what you think it means. The Department of Justice has its own secret understanding of imminent, and that just means that they think the person has in the past constituted a threat. They don't have to have any evidence suggesting he's planning to attack a U.S. person or the United States right now.
Well, that is the thing that I mean, there's a couple of things, but basically this argues, and we should say that there are three tenets, essentially, which describe the circumstances where this would be lawful, according to this document. An informed high-level official of the U.S. government has determined that the targeted individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. That's number one. And what it seems to do, and we can get to the notion of an informed high-level official, but what it seems to do is simply take the concept of imminent threat and completely personify it, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what this person's about to do. It sort of just gets to the nature of the person, it seems to me.
That's exactly right. It's who the person is. So we think that we have good reason to believe that this person is a senior figure within Al-Qaeda or an associated group. That's good enough. He constitutes a threat.
Now, it seems to me, incredibly broad, and it would say that the only way that that person, once it's been determined, and we don't know exactly how that determination is made, but once it's been determined that that person represents just by their being, essentially, an imminent threat, they have to go to what seems to be impossible lengths to sort of de-imminent threatize themselves in some way.
Can they surrender? Can they turn themselves in? Well, I mean, if it's secret, you don't even know you've been targeted, you don't really have an opportunity to turn yourself in. That's one of the huge questions here. A lot of people have read it has said that, you know, you have to, this is a matter of international law, you have to give a person a reasonable opportunity to surrender. And that's not in this memo. So that's one of the real question marks hanging over it.
And was not when al-Awlaki's father went to court in an attempt to essentially, once he became aware that there was reporting that his son was on a list to be killed by the U.S. government, and he went to court in an attempt to argue to get him get his son off that list. Why was that not sufficient?
Well, the courts concluded they just didn't have jurisdiction over this. There's nothing they could do about it. And, you know, I mean, we've now had a couple of rulings to that effect, but the principal ruling came out of Washington sometime back. But I think this opens up this big question of, you know, is this decision not subject to any sort of accountability in courts whatsoever, even when it involves taking the life of an American citizen? Because if Barack Obama wanted to throw somebody in prison, he'd have to go to a court. He'd have to have a court's okay to do it. So it doesn't seem to make sense that you have to have that permission to jail someone, but you don't to kill them. And then let's just deal with the question. So what about you did kill them, and what about you made a mistake? You were wrong. You had bad evidence. Is there no remedy at all? Do the children, the survivors of this person who was killed, not have any claim against the government? Because our tradition is one where we hold governments to account for their wrongful actions. And this this Justice Department memo is predicated on the notion of immunity or impunity. That is, there's no accountability for the government when it makes these decisions, even if it makes serious mistakes.
And that gets to the determination by a, quote, informed high-level official of the U.S. government, and that person's determination of that the subject is, you know, by their existence, an imminent threat, right? I mean, because, you know, you use the example of this hostage situation in Alabama. There's transparency, certainly after the fact, and to a certain extent before the fact. There's none here.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, this question of a high government official, well, if we go back to the presidency of Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan, who followed him, both of those presidents laid out a very clear rule, which was they said no assassinations. But if you look deep into the details of what they wrote, they didn't actually say no assassinations. They said no assassinations unless the president himself on his authority has authorized it. So they said basically you got a high political price here. The president's got to step up to the plate and say, I'll do this. And we're not allowing other people to make that decision. Now, what we see in this Justice Department memo is graying that out. I mean, just a high government official. Well, presumably, that seems to read John O. Brennan as the person who gets to decide all these things, which is the reason why this is a ripe question for him at the time of his confirmation. But it also seems to suggest the president can just delegate this to a number of other people. That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing if you want to keep this awesome power, which you can't shut out altogether. If you want to keep it under tight control and used very rarely, it really should be limited to the president.
Well, I mean, that is one of the questions, at least in that first tenet, that also seems to be like, I mean, let me put it this way. Who is not, I mean, who would not be considered a high-level government official? In other words, can a cabinet member, any cabinet member make this determination? Can any appointed official by the president make this? I mean, that seems to be the problem here, is that there's really no is high level official. Is that a specific term of, I mean, do we know who that does and does not apply to? I mean, in this instance, we know that it's that in this case, anyways, it's John Brennan. But do we know that there aren't John Brennan's assistant can't do this? Do we know that? I mean, do we have any sense of who that person would be?
No, we don't know. I mean, this is not a term of art, high government official. I mean, there are very clear ways of setting a limited list of people. I mean, there are provisions of the U.S. Code that designate certain categories of civil servants. You could talk about cabinet officers and sub-cabinet officers, or you could talk about people whose office depends on senatorial appointment and confirmation. And Brennan is not one of those. I mean, you know, he holds the position he has now because it was realized early on that he could not be confirmed as director of the CIA. So he's just you know, he serves at the pleasure of the president without senatorial appointment or a confirmation. So that would suggest, you know, we're going pretty far down the list. And I think, you know, this is a really fair question, and it's a question for him, but it's also a question for Barack Obama.
And okay, so the second thing that this white paper purports to lay out is that that the notion of capture of the subject, of the person to be killed, is infeasible. And this also has a very broad definition, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I think this is after imminence. This is the other really key criterion. And I think the question is essentially this: why didn't you capture the guy? Why didn't you arrest him? Why didn't you interrogate him? That's a question, in fact, that John Yoo and Michael Hyden have been pressing. You know, Bush administration officials have been pressing with Obama and Brent. An absolutely fair question. And I think when you look at this memo, they say infeasible. Now, it's another case where infeasible doesn't mean what you think it means. Because as they appear to apply this in cases like Somalia and Yemen, it appears to mean inconvenient to do it. Because it's quite clear that in both of those countries, you could seek to arrest this person, you could try to use local authorities to do it, you could send people in to do it. There's, of course, some risk that people on the ground might be shot, just as happens with police officers affecting an arrest here in New York City or in Washington or in any other urban area. And I think what you see here is them saying it's really not convenient to do that. We would really just rather kill them. So the standard of infeasibility looks pretty weak the way it's being applied. And that is something that is really troubling, particularly to our allies, the people in Europe who are concerned about these sorts of tactics occurring, you know, not in Somalia, but next year maybe in Berlin, London, or Paris.
The memo specifically says other factors such as undue risk to U.S. personnel conducting a potential capture operation could be relevant. Feasibility would be a highly fact-specific and potentially time-sensitive inquiry. So on one hand, it gives this sort of very broad notion of what would constitute undue risk to U.S. personnel. I mean, we have special ops that get involved in what, you know, some people would call maybe even, you know, close to suicide missions. I mean, so what, you know, the undue risk seems to me to be could be defined from surely to a unit sent in to capture him would be subjected to sure casualties, all the way down to, you know, it's possibly, that maybe people could get injured, or maybe, there's a flu epidemic there. I mean, that seems to me to be almost meaningless at that point in terms of a parameter that is being set for the feasibility of capture.
I agree with you, absolutely. And I think, frankly, we can look at, you know, I hate to be to make arguments in support of President Bush and his team, but, you know, there's a meaningful distinction here, and that is you look at the last 2 years of the Bush presidency, and you compare them with the Obama presidency, and there is a complete departure on this point. That is, Bush would regularly, routinely seize or capture people. And is presented with the same circumstances, the Obama administration pulls the trigger or fires that drone rocket. That is, they choose the lethal option over the capture option time and time again.
And let me also ask you, why Al-Qaeda? I mean, why? I mean, is it, you know, I'm trying to find in here, and, you know, obviously I'm not an attorney. 1 year of law school, but we never got into this type of stuff. But why Al-Qaeda? I mean, is that simply a function or associated groups? Why is it what in this document says that it's ultimately restricted to Al-Qaeda, but for the fact that it keeps mentioning Al-Qaeda? In other words, if this is built on the notion of an individual posing an imminent threat, a violent attack against the United States, the capture isn't infeasible because it could risk casualties to U.S. personnel. Why would this necessarily be restricted to Al-Qaeda? I mean, if the government was aware that an extreme anti-abortionist was the type of person who has exemplified in the past that they could be a threat to U.S. citizens because they're going to do a bombing or something like that, why would that person not be subjected to this?
Well, this memo deals with Al-Qaeda and associated forces, so that's not to say that there might not be other circumstances where DOJ will be prepared to justify it potentially in other terms. But I think there's a technical legal reason for this, and that is they're looking at the use of the military and military power, i.e. drones, and they have to have congressional action that specifically authorizes that overseas. And that brings you back to the authorization for the use of military force, and that's the language in the authorization for the use of military force as it's been interpreted by the Obama administration. So it's sort of a series of pretty technical readings of the statute. And by the way, I'm thankful for these readings that limit its scope because now, there are not a lot of them.
Yeah, and now, but this also says it does not, the paper specifically says this paper does not attempt to determine the minimum requirements necessary to render such an operation lawful. Does that mean that essentially we're not talking about, we're not saying that it has to clear this bar? We're just saying that this bar, wherever that bar may be, is cleared.
Well, this is one of the reasons why we really want to see the real memo rather than this summary, because it's one of the points where the summary is quite muddled as to how these things apply. And I'd say, you know, what we see in this memo looks a lot like some reverse engineering. So we've struck Anwar al-Awlaki, and we've struck actually his son, too. And we got to justify that. So after the fact, we're going back and creating a legal memorandum that justifies what we did. It does not read like a memo that's dispensing advice in advance about how to assess and evaluate these cases and decide whether they're legal. Now, I'm hoping the AOLC memo does a better job of that, but this document definitely doesn't.
So are you suggesting that at the very least this memo is something that is – it was not set out – in other words, the Obama administration didn't start with here is our policy and then let's see who conforms to this policy, but rather – we've made this decision. Now we have to write something that would conform to the actions that we took.
Exactly right. And that's the same as is the case with the torture memos. I mean, in the case of the torture memos, we know now very clearly torture came first and the memos came later. They were an attempt after the fact to justify what had happened. That's the same thing with this OLC memo. Which is surprising when you've got Barack Obama, you know, insisting on making these memos public, insisting the Justice Department is not going to operate the way it did in the Bush years with respect to such sensitive matters. But on this score, it definitely is operating that way.
Why do you think that, I mean, this was a document that was given to intelligence committee members in June, according to the report from Michael Isikoff. Why do you think that it would have been delivered in this manner as opposed to the specific memos themselves?
Well, I think it was well, we have the same question with respect to the surveillance issue when members of Congress pressed aggressively to get all of the memos, the OLC memos. Justice didn't want to give those memos. Instead, it gave a white paper. In that case, it gave actually a pretty good detailed white paper that allows us to understand pretty much what their legal analysis was. In this case, they gave us a piece of trash because that's what this white paper is. I mean, it's the people who wrote this may be good writing speeches, but they don't really seem to be on the top of the game of legal analysis because they botched too many things. So I don't think this really is a good summary of the Lederman-Barron memo, and I think we really need to see that. But I think it was designed as something just as a sop. You guys want to know what our legal analysis is? Here it is. But this really isn't a sufficient response, and it really doesn't give us a clear, complete understanding of what their legal analysis is.
I mean, but what do you think the motivations behind that are? I mean, is it, you know, presumably you would write one of these so that it would be people would be more understanding of the legal reasoning if they're not legal scholars, right? But I mean, do you think that this document is trying to in some way round certain edges that might be even more offensive in some ways?
Well, I think that's likely. So, I mean, you look at the speeches that were given by Brennan and Eric Holder, and one thing you'll see is that their speeches present a far narrower and tighter understanding of the president's authority than this memo does. Now, that's one reason to be concerned. But, you know, we also have to be concerned about the fact that Barack Obama promised that he was going to operate in openness, that he was not going to have this tradition of secrecy that we had in the Bush years, that people would know certainly their legal policy and legal analysis. You know, that promise is just being violated here. And, you know, we've got 11 members of the Senate now signing a letter saying publish the OLC memo. And we have Eric Holder at the press conference when confronted with that question. And I don't know if you watched that, but he disintegrated into complete gibberish. He could not articulate a reason why the OLC memo could not be made public, because there isn't a good one.
Now, one thing that struck me was that in the the definition of imminent, in contrast to the arguments about capture being infeasible, and the third principle, the operation would be conducted in a manner consistent with applicable law of war principles, there was no legal citations. I mean, this may get to, you know, sort of the flaws that you see in this document, but there were only essentially law articles, as far as I can tell. There was no legal citations. I mean, it seems to me that the imminent area is either represented in a very poor way in this situation, or it's an area that has been ambiguous in the past in terms of court cases.
Well, I'd say the killer capture issue as an international humanitarian law issue is an extremely hot topic, and it's one where the United States has taken a very, very aggressive position that most other nations and the Red Cross don't agree with, and that's one of the reasons why they have a hard time citing authorities to support their views. But, you know, that's really at the heart of this. You know, in theory, you know, we send people in and we tell them, you know, capture the guy, or if you can't capture him, kill him, and almost all these raids result in deaths these days, and there really has not been a good explanation for that so far. But on the other hand, you also have to agree that in this life or death, you know, drama that's going on when these missions are carried out, you have to give the special services people who are carrying it out some latitude to make a decision. But I am very troubled about what they're being told, and I'm very troubled about the preference in using drones rather than special ops agents.
What is it about that is particularly troubling?
Because the preference, I mean, particularly when you're dealing with a U.S. citizen, the preference should be to capture this person and bring him in. And, you know, if he's done a criminal act, charge him. convict him and put him in prison. And not to have, by presidential edict, the administration of a death penalty.
Now, in terms of just the flaws that you see in this document, what are the most glaring ones that you perceive are flaws of this document, as opposed or in the way that it represents the what you believe might be in the original memo?
Well, I'd say, you know, they're basically two separate prongs to this. So one is a constitutional law analysis of what is due process in a case like this. And there's a very important Supreme Court decision called Matthews versus Eldridge, which sets out, you know, what the considerations would be, you know, for such an exercise. And I think one of the disturbing things is that this white paper doesn't properly restate the rule of the case, that it removes one of the factors from consideration, and that's a factor that has to do with alternative remedies and, you know, less forceful, less lethal remedies that would be particularly important here, and they just ignore that. So, and that's the sort of mistake that, you know, a young lawyer or a law student, if they made that in a paper or a brief, they get in a lot of trouble for that. And for that to happen in a DOJ white paper, I think is pretty disturbing. The other thing is, you know, all these international humanitarian law standards, you know, war, theater of action, and things like that, these things are a muddle in this brief. They're not fully developed and they're not answered. And it leaves me only with a lot of questions about what their view is. And finally, I'd say there's a question of these two prongs. So we have the constitutional analysis and we have the law of war analysis. And this brief doesn't make us clear whether it's saying you have to satisfy both of these analyses or whether you have to satisfy only one of them. If it's saying you have to satisfy both of them, that's a good starting point. I'd be happy with that. But it's completely unclear.
Interesting. And getting back to the judicial review, one of the things that Holder had said, I guess, in his press conference at the I guess it was in the fall, was that due process does not require judicial review in this instance. Is that, I mean, just give us a sense of how of the foundation of that claim.
Well, I think most people would agree that it doesn't require court process in every instance. And, you know, I think there are cases where the circumstances are extremely exigent and action has to be taken. And I think people can understand that the government has to make a decision on its own. And there may be an internal requirement of due process. And that's what the Matthews v. Eldridge case talks about here. But, you know, what's troubling here is a circumstance where they've got a target, they pick him out, and then they take months to decide to do anything, and then they do it. I mean, in that circumstance, it's very, very difficult to understand why there can't be some other form of due process, why the person who's targeted can't be permitted somehow to challenge and get judicial review about it. And I think the key question we've got in the end of the day is what happens when they make a mistake? What happens when they make a serious mistake? You know, they've done all this careful factual exploration, but what if it's wrong? And I think we've got the case already of Anwar al-Awlaki's son, who was killed. And we know that U.S. intelligence decided that he had reached the age of majority and therefore was a legitimate target. And they say they had very carefully studied all that and reached that conclusion. Well, that was wrong. He was a minor. And that was a result of negligence because he had a Colorado driver's license. They could have just checked with the records in Colorado and they would have known he was a minor and therefore was not a legitimate target. So, I mean, this is already one example. So what are the consequences of them making a serious mistake in a case like this? Is there an ability of the heirs to bring a claim for damages? Is there any accountability for the people who made the mistake if it was negligent? Those are really important issues that have to be addressed. And I think what we see in this Department of Justice memorandum is no, just complete immunity and impunity for government actors, which is an increasing part of our culture these days. That is, no government official makes a is ever accountable for any mistake he makes, even if it if it costs someone their life.
Does the fact that they do take months, weeks, maybe more in some instances, in terms of their determination as to whether or not this person deserves to be on the disposition matrix that they have been reported to have created, does that fundamentally undercut the argument that in this instance due process would not involve in any way a some form of judicial review? I think we can understand that concept of due process when you have a genuine imminent threat. In other words, one that is sort of based on timeliness. But it seems to me that if you can afford to take several months to make this determination, then it is a sort of it seems to be a prima facie evidence that you, in fact, do have time to have genuine judicial review.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the other argument, of course, they make is, oh, well, you know, these are tactical decisions, tactical operations. We can't have courts come in and be involved with that. And, of course, the answer there is that, yeah, well, tactical operations are supposed to be kept secret. Now, what went on with Al-Awlaki is the government says this is super secret. They say that to the courts. And then John O'Brien sits down and gives a multi-hour-long interview with the Washington Times in which he talks all about it. And he talks all about it for political reasons, to say, you know, the fact that we're going after Al-Awlaki and we're going to kill him just shows, you know, what hairy-chested, proactive operators we are in dealing with terrorist threats. Well, it can't be both things here. I mean, you know, if it really is secret, it should be secret. And John O'Brien shouldn't be out talking to his favorite journalists on the Rolodex and giving them all sorts of inside tips about what's going on. And I think, you know, this is really one of the fundamental questions about Brennan that I hope someone's pressing at the at the confirmation hearings tomorrow.
What do you think? I mean, just lastly, like the implications of this hearing. It seems to me this hearing is nomination hearings are going to be incredibly important in terms of getting a bellwether of just how much our elected representatives are willing to promote this notion of transparency. I mean, the closer we get to this, and with this information, and the fact that we now know senators on that committee all have at the very least this information, is going to be. It seems to me it's going to be a crucial bellwether as to whether or not there's going to be any accountability for these type of operations, for the type of operations that took place under the Bush administration as well in some respects.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think I hope that the hearings provide an opportunity for Congress to really dig in deep to these issues about the drone program, which was really masterminded and overseen by Brennan, and, you know, to ask why this is being run by the CIA instead of the military, for instance, and many, many other questions. It's really distressing that there haven't been such hearings so far, and I think it would present a sort of a failure of the system, of the oversight system, if the only time we can have any meaningful discussion of these things is when someone is nominated to be director of the CIA. This should be a part of ongoing oversight, but we've created a non-oversight system. That is, we have the select committees on intelligence, and I see very little evidence that they ever conduct any oversight of any kind. And they certainly don't do it in a public way so that the public is not informed about the issues and has no opportunity to participate in it. This is, I think, a very, very disappointing aspect of our current system.
Scott Horton, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about this today.
Always a pleasure. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. Thanks. All right, folks. We've got to take a break. Let me just also just read Ron Wyden, who has been sounding Senator Ron Wyden, who is a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, has been sounding the alarm about this, and frankly also, I should say, has been sounding the alarm about the government's interpretation of FISA for some time now, suggesting that there are at least one or two memos out there by the OLC that wherein the government interprets their ability to spy on Americans in a way that he has suggested would be completely repellent to Americans if they were aware of this. And he put out a statement yesterday, I believe it was. The Justice Department memo that was made public yesterday touches on a number of important issues, but it leaves many of the most important questions about the president's lethal authorities unanswered. Questions like, how much evidence does the president need to decide that a particular American is part of a terrorist group? Does the president have to provide individual Americans with the opportunity to surrender? Can the president order intelligence agencies or the military to kill an American who's inside the United States? I would suggest that the questions actually go further in the ones that we discussed today. With Scott Horton as to can you be more clear on what constitutes an imminent threat? Can you be more clear on those situations where you deem a capture impossible based upon the undue risk that it would pose to American personnel? It will be very distressing if we do not see these questions asked forcefully tomorrow. That will be... I don't think you can overstate. It's incredibly distressing that this is going on in the White House, but it's that much more bleak if we don't even have senators who are armed with these information, with these questions, and don't raise them at the hearings tomorrow. So we will see. In the meantime, we're going to take a break and head to the better half of the program, wherein we will talk about this New York Police Department spy case that is taking place. The post office, for those who have not heard reports on this show for, gosh, over the past year and a half now, I think, on the undue burdens placed on the post office and their attempts to get themselves out of this. And really what is an attempt by Republicans in particular, but others, to privatize the U.S. Postal Services. We will discuss that in the better half, as well as the report that apparently Pennsylvania will not expand Medicaid coverage for people who are within 133% of the poverty line. All that and more. Folks, you can support this program, which is supported virtually exclusively by members supporting this program. I mean, I was going to say, in the event that we get sued for patent infringement, that may not be enough. But, you know, contemplate what would happen if these patent trolls are able to shut down shows like this one. Contemplate what you would be left listening to. Apparently, Chris Matthews on Hardball yesterday, I didn't see it, but was quoted as saying, "Well, Leon Panetta, he's got integrity. He goes to church every day, right? He's conscientious." Speaking of the current CIA chief, if that is the what is it?
He's a defense secretary.
Oh, he's a defense secretary. Former CIA. Former CIA chief, but presumably went to church during that time as well.
Not at all.
No, and I mean just. Contemplate the implications of that statement. Regardless of whether or not you have issues with religion, the idea that somehow we should just say, don't worry about this dude. He goes to church every day, is bizarro world. It's just bizarro world. That this is what the liberal voice apparently is promoting to us. Don't worry about it. These guys go to church. What happens if we get someone who doesn't go to church? Are we, are these laws still applicable?
stop. Well, they'll start dropping mini nukes on Pakistan and Yemen
right.
because of the lack of church attendance.
That's the real problem. And they'll just leave them around because they're not conscientious.
Hey, I don't go to church.
I don't
Whatever.
Go to church. What am I supposed to keep control of these things? Well, the point being, if you find this show of value or of valuable just because sometimes I can be mildly entertaining, please support this program if you can afford to by becoming a member today at majority.fm. You can find the link at the top of the page. Become a member. It is your support that makes this show possible. Other ways of supporting this show, if you buy stuff on Amazon, buy it through our link. You can find that at majority.fm and then click the link, support the show at the top. It'll show you how. Very simple to do. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It is, again, but it's your memberships that really make this show possible. And we have a lot of members who can't afford to pay, a lot of listeners who can't. We know this from surveys. We know this from emails. So if you're one that is fortunate enough to be able to afford 35 cents a day to support this program, I hope you will decide to do so. All right, folks, what's that?
This is from NBC. Senator Ron Wyden just said that the administration is, quote, stonewalling on targeted killings, and he'll, quote, put out all the stops during the Brennan process to get more info. So
well, it should be
interesting. We'll see what that means, but that's potentially really interesting.
And those are starting tomorrow, I imagine, at 9 a.m. So we'll have coverage on that. We're also going to be talking to Ari Berman tomorrow, I believe, about the Voting Rights Act. But we will have sound, hopefully, from the Brennan hearing, and we will certainly be talking about it. All right, folks, you can be a part of this program by calling 646-257-3920. If you are one of those people who I tweeted out a joke on Twitter yesterday in response to that Chris Matthews thing that was, wait a second, I don't go to church and I don't kill people with drones. Nothing makes sense anymore. And then all of a sudden, like, the Obama bots come out of nowhere and accuse me of saying that Obama is like Bush. Now, the interesting thing about that was that that's obviously the process that was going on in those person's mind. They somehow, by I have no idea however how they would do this, but associated the assassination of American citizens with drones. Never mind the issues with signature strikes and whatnot in general, with being like Bush. But I'm happy to hear from some of those people who feel that I am an emo prog. And what's the other thing that they call people?
I know emo prog.
There's
that's the one I know.
Something baggers. I don't know what it is. Flaming baggers or something like that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it is. But I'm willing to hear your arguments on this. It would be fascinating for all of us to hear.
Oh, my God, Sam. Stop whining. Jesus.
Stop complaining. Let me get so emotional. And, of course, we welcome all libertarian callers who I know are just outraged at this. I imagine there some are, but we never hear from those. All right, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with the better half.